From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I heard George Bush get up and say, I served in the 187th Air National Guard in Montgomery, Alabama. Really? You know, that was my unit. And I don't remember seeing you there.
Bush's Vietnam record comes under attack in a new ad and new documents surface about his role in the National Guard. We'll speak with Ian Williams, author of Deserter.
Well, every new document that turns up shows the same thing. He failed to turn up for his duty. He was a deserter.
Four aid workers, two Italian, two Iraqi, are abducted in Iraq in one of the most chilling kidnappings since the occupation began. We'll go to Italy to speak with the head of the aid organization. And we'll speak with whistleblowers from Britain and Denmark. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Financial Times is reporting the White House and Attorney General John Ashcroft have pressured the FBI not to prosecute senior officials in connection with the investigation over who within the Pentagon leaked top secret information to Israel and AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. One former intelligence official told the Financial Times, quote, the White House is leaning on the FBI. Some people in the FBI are very upset. They think Ashcroft is playing politics with this. In Indonesia, at least eight people have been killed, about 100 injured, in a bomb blast outside the Australian embassy in Jakarta. Police said the blast was likely the result of a car bomb. President Bush yesterday announced support for a new national intelligence director to solve the lack of coordination among agencies in the lead-up to the attacks on September 11th. The 9/11 Commission had recommended creating a position where the new intelligence director would be a cabinet-level position and given full budget authority. Bush has proposed a scaled-back position where the director controls about two-thirds of the overall intelligence budget. In Iraq, one U.S. soldier was killed, two others injured in a roadside bomb in Baghdad. In Fallujah, the U.S. has carried out another round of bombing, which has killed six, injured 23. In the province of Anbar, members of the Iraqi resistance have kidnapped the deputy governor. Meanwhile, The Guardian is reporting that the remaining international aid agencies in Iraq are considering pulling out of the country after the kidnapping of four humanitarian workers, including two Italian women, from their headquarters in Baghdad. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. Tonight, across the country, over 600 silent candlelight vigils are scheduled to mark the deaths of the 1,000th soldier in Iraq. The vigils are being organized by Win Without War, with backing from United for Peace and Justice, Move On, Veterans for Peace, and other groups. Meanwhile, last night in Iowa City, critics of the war put on a display of 1,000 footprints to symbolize the lives lost in Iraq. A new investigation by UPI and CNN found that a controversial anti-malaria drug called Larium might have led to six Special Forces soldiers committing suicide. The joint investigation uncovered what reporters described as a startling pattern of violence and suicide by the country's most elite soldiers who use the drug. California Senator Dianne Feinstein is calling on the Pentagon to reassess its use of the drug. The report also says Larium might have played a role in three cases in 2002 when Special Forces soldiers at Fort Bragg murdered their wives and then committed suicide. The New York Times is reporting that the White House recently called the president of NBC News to discourage the network from broadcasting interviews with best-selling biographer Kitty Kelly. Kelly has authored a new book on the Bush family that charges President Bush was a cocaine user and that he once used cocaine at Camp David while his father was president. In other TV news, viewers in multiple markets reported last night their local CBS affiliate opted not to broadcast 60 Minutes, which aired a segment raising new questions about President Bush's military record in the National Guard. In Lubbock, Texas, the station aired a pre-recorded show for the St. Jude's Children's Charity and held 60 Minutes until 1:35 in the morning. WTVR in Virginia reportedly aired a special 15-minute weather report at the top of the hour that coincided with the portion of 60 Minutes that discussed Bush. WYOU in Pennsylvania claimed the station had transmitter problems during the hour. In Oklahoma, the local CBS affiliate had planned to not air 60 Minutes until 3:15 in the morning, but the station caved in under a campaign by the Progressive Alliance Foundation. In West Virginia, one of the state's five Republican electors is threatening to vote against President Bush in the Electoral College if the president carries the state's popular vote. Richie Robb, who is the mayor of South Charleston, said he would do so to protest what he believes are misguided policies of the current administration. He said, quote, "I know that among some in my own party, what I'm discussing would be considered treasonous. But I'm not going to cheerlead us down the primrose path when I know we're being led in the wrong direction," he said. Meanwhile, the Log Cabin Republicans have announced they will not endorse President Bush in the November election to protest his opposition to same-sex marriage. The group is the party's largest gay and lesbian bloc. In voting news, the state of California has joined a lawsuit against Diebold that alleges the electronic voting company sold the state equipment that could allow the elections to be manipulated by a hacker or disrupted by software bugs. The lawsuit was originally filed by electronic voting critic Bev Harris. A new report from the Center for Public Integrity has found that both President Bush and John Kerry are relying on some of the same major corporations to fund their campaigns. Employees from four companies have given enough money to each candidate to be among the top largest contributors for each campaign. The companies are all financial corporations. They're Citigroup, the Goldman Sachs Group, Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter and Company, as well as UBS AG Inc. For the third time this year, a federal judge has ruled an attempt by Congress to impose a federal ban on some forms of abortion is unconstitutional. A Nebraska judge rejected the so-called Partial Birth Abortion Act of 2003 because it lacks an exception for when a woman's health is at risk. In the Caribbean, Hurricane Ivan has killed at least 15 people. In Grenada, the country's prime minister told the BBC the island is 90% devastated. 125-mile-an-hour winds hit Grenada's capital, St. George. The Category 5 storm is forecast to strike Jamaica on Friday and Cuba over the weekend. Hurricane Ivan is believed to be the worst hurricane to hit the Caribbean in over a decade.
واخترت للنصيب بيتا لعلني به صائب أنتم البرد.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. International aid organizations and non-governmental organizations are deciding whether to stay in Iraq after the abduction earlier this week of two Italian and two Iraqi humanitarian workers in broad daylight from their offices in Baghdad. It was one of the most chilling abductions in a country gripped by a wave of kidnappings. Witnesses said on Tuesday 20 men armed with AK-47 assault rifles and pistols with silencers stopped vehicles in a busy commercial area of the capital and raided a building housing the humanitarian organization A Bridge to Baghdad, which has operated in Iraq since 1992. The gunmen took Italian Simona Pari and Simona Toretta, along with Iraqi staffers Raad Ali Abdulaziz and Manoz Bassam. Witnesses say the gunmen dragged Bassam away by her hair, screaming. Since April, foreigners from more than two dozen countries have been kidnapped as guerrillas try to force foreign troops and firms to leave. More than 20 of those kidnapped have been killed. It still isn't clear who abducted the women and the man, or why. A statement posted on an Islamic website by a group calling itself Ansar al-Zawahiri claimed responsibility and said the kidnapping marked the first of our attacks against Italy. The group demanded that Italy withdraw its troops and, quote, stop killing Muslims in Iraq and cooperating with American forces. But there was no way of authenticating the statement, which was not accompanied by the photos or video footage typically issued by groups that have seized more than 100 foreign hostages in Iraq this year. During the more than a decade of economic sanctions against Iraq, most humanitarian groups refused to operate in the country. But A Bridge to Baghdad defied that in the belief that the suffering of civilians should not be used as a political bargaining chip. The group opposed the sanctions, it opposed the invasion, and it opposes the occupation. In Italy, the group has been a leading critic of the government's decision to join the U.S.-led coalition. Dozens of groups around the world have signed on to an appeal to the kidnappers, saying the four hostages, quote, are not enemies of the Iraqi people. They stand shoulder to shoulder with them in calling for an immediate end to the occupation. We appeal to those holding them to release them immediately, said the statement. We're joined now by two people. Kathy Kelly is with us, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She worked closely with A Bridge to Baghdad for many years in Iraq. We're also joined from Italy by Ornella Sanguivani, coordinator of Bridge to Baghdad. Until the beginning of the invasions, she was head of the organization's anti-sanctions campaign. She's worked with Bridge to Baghdad since 1996. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ornella, let's start with you. Can you talk about what you know at this point and how people in Italy right now are responding?
Well, Amy, what we do know is exactly what you said now. We don't know any new information. We don't have further information. This is what we got from the news wire, and there's nothing more we know. Well, the response of the Italians has been stunning, really, as people are taking to the streets all over Italy in small, self-organized, some small and some larger self-organized events, and nationwide people are taking to the streets, organizing vigils, organizing sit-ins, organizing demonstrations, marches. It's really, we are so touched. We are so touched by this huge nationwide response, huge solidarity, this warm feeling we feel around us.
Can you talk about who the four workers are? Can you tell us about them personally?
Well, I can talk about three workers because two Italians are our people and one Iraqi, one of those kidnapped, is one Iraqi working for us. I don't know much about the fourth one because she's working with another Italian NGO called InterSOS. So what I do know about them is the two Italian women, one of them I have known her since a long time. She joined the association in 1999, 1996, Simona Toretta. She's been very active both in humanitarian and peace action work throughout all these years. She went to Iraq several times, and she was there back in Iraq since early April last year, the outbreak of the war, and then she stayed there coordinating our activities. The other woman, Simona Pari, she joined us last year, last fall. Actually, she was working with Save the Children first, and then she joined us in a program for helping children, and she has stayed working with us on this. She was in charge of the program to get children back to schools, huge program we have in several schools in Baghdad, primary schools in Baghdad, being there for the last almost a year, yes, coordinating this project. And the Iraqi who was kidnapped is a wonderful person. Kathy also could say something about him because she knew him. He's the engineer Raad Ali Abdulaziz, and academic professor and an engineer. He was coordinating our work. In fact, he was a cornerstone of our office in Baghdad, organizing recently our aid convoys to Fallujah in spring and then to Najaf, and really bearing most of the weight of the organizing working in Iraq. Wonderful person.
Kathy Kelly, you know him. Can you describe your work with him? Kathy works with Voices in the Wilderness, describing one of the four aid workers who were abducted, Raad Ali Abdulaziz.
Well, Amy, one thing I noticed is that almost every person that traveled over to Iraq who met Raad would be coming back to the United States wanting to tell stories about this extraordinary person, because his life and interest has made it so accessible to better understand that Iraqis are ordinary people with loves and interests very similar to ours. The first time I met Raad, he was showing me a picture of a Frank Lloyd Wright building and asking me, do you by any chance know about this building? And it was one of the ones near our home here in Chicago. And he just is so easily thrilled with the gift of a book or with certain pictures that he prizes. And among the pictures he most prizes are ones of the stars that he's taken himself, because every time that there was a protracted war in his country, when he was a kid at age 7, when he was a teenager, most recently during the Desert Fox and the Shock and Awe campaigns, he's known that when the lights go out all over Baghdad, that is one time when you can pull out a telescope and study the stars as never before. And so his avocation as an amateur astronomer was really developed while bombs were exploding nearby. And he, like Simona Toretta, whom we've also had such deep admiration for, simply could not be deterred by the kinds of fears that often can overtake people. Immediately after the Shock and Awe campaign had ended, they were both out and about trying to devise ways to be very practical of great service. And that Bridges to Baghdad has done. Plus, their character in the way that they've approached these enormously complicated and difficult situations, it has always been a witness toward the most humanitarian kind of effort possible. It's a nightmare to think of these people being abducted and subjected perhaps to great fear and punishment at this moment. But most of all, I think we need to uphold what they've stood for as a witness against war.
Ornella, have you heard any more about this organization calling itself Ansar al-Zawahiri, which has claimed responsibility and said the kidnapping marks, quote, the first of our attacks against Italy?
What I do know is that since the first time that this name appears, and what I read in the newspapers, is that the claim isn't deemed credible. I mean, experts say that. I have no way to tell whether it's true or whether it's credible, but what I am hearing and what I'm reading that it isn't deemed credible, and they say the language they used in the statement not credible.
Now, Kathy, you had more details than we've read in the paper about how planned this abduction was, about two of the people actually going in dressed as businessmen. Can you describe what you know?
Well, just the description that witnesses said, it was very, very chilling that the people who surrounded the house where Bridges to Baghdad's office was located were holding AK-47s with silencers and pistols, that two men dressed in a, you know, more of a business suit type apparel went in and dragged out the four workers, that this did seem to be not a kind of criminal robbery abduction aimed at getting a ransom. But as Ornella says, there simply is no information available. We don't know why these four people were chosen. We don't know who has done this. It's part of what makes such a nightmare of it. I can imagine that Ornella and all of the staff in Rome are frantic for this knowledge, and yet it's just simply not there. And again, it's the consequence of war and occupation.
Ornella Sangiovanni, what are you doing in Iraq right now? Are you making any special appeals in the Iraqi press?
We are issuing several appeals, and we have them translated into Arabic, and we are spreading these appeals, different mailing lists and websites, and trying to reach Iraqi press. And we do have some local partners to local NGOs who are still working with us, and what I know is that they are mobilizing and they are organizing events and they are organizing demonstration. One was supposed to take place today in Baghdad with children and women calling for the release of our colleagues and Italian and Iraqi. So
we have to break for a minute, but when we come back, I want to ask you about the politics of the occupation in Italy and how people have responded. You're a longtime anti-war group, and yet Berlusconi, the head of Italy, is a very close ally of President Bush. And I'd like to get the latest on that political situation in light of the kidnappings. We're talking with Kathy Kelly and Ornella Sangiovanni about the kidnapping of the four workers at A Bridge to Baghdad. We'll be back in a minute.
هي عليا
This is Democracy Now! We're wrapping up our discussion about the four people, two Italian, two Iraqi, who were arrested from, who were kidnapped from A Bridge to Baghdad, the peace organization based in Baghdad, Iraq. We're speaking with the head of the organization in Rome, Italy, Ornella Sangiovanni, as well as Kathy Kelly, who's founder of Voices in the Wilderness, that work closely with A Bridge to Baghdad. Ornella, the politics of the occupation in Iraq and what Berlusconi responses right now, a close ally of George Bush?
Well, unfortunately, I have to stress that probably the country which has the biggest anti-war movement, at least in Europe, Italy, has also the one of the few governments supporting shamefully politics of war of President Bush. I wouldn't say United States. I wouldn't say United States. I would say President Bush administration.
And what has been the response to the kidnapping?
Well, the response to the kidnapping has been of shame and outrage. I mean, by the people. The response from the government, they summoned the opposition leader. They thought that this time they would probably need the support of the opposition leader in House and the Senate. They felt that they wouldn't be able to handle politically the situation by majority only. And there's a strange feeling that we don't know, actually. We hope that the government is going to handle the situation doing no harm. We don't know whether they will do any good, but we do hope they're going to do no harm. In the past, they didn't show, there's no a very much reason to be confident. In fact, they didn't show very particularly skillful in handling this situation. Even recently, we had a journalist, a freelance journalist, a peace-loving person, kidnapped and killed very, very quickly by a so-called Islamic group. The government handled the situation, or maybe the way they didn't handle the situation has been very, very poor. Don't have a good record.
Ornella Sangiovanni, I want to thank you for being with us. Also, Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, and we will certainly continue to follow the story. Ornella, the head of Bridge to Baghdad, she is speaking to us from Rome. Her colleagues, four, were kidnapped in Baghdad. This is Democracy Now! As we move on now to our second segment, the United States reaching the grim milestone this week of 1,000 U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq. While Iraq remains a central issue in the race for the White House, another war has become a major focus of the media and presidential campaigns, and that is Vietnam. Republicans launched a relentless campaign against John Kerry, accusing the decorated Vietnam combat veteran of fabricating the events that led to his five medals. Meanwhile, Democrats are pointing to gaps in President Bush's stateside Air National Guard service in 72 and 73 to say that Bush shirked his duty. In the latest news, new documents from Bush's squadron commander say Bush discussed with him how to avoid drills during 1972. The report on 60 Minutes said the files were from the personal records of Colonel Jerry Killian, who died in 1984. The files show that Killian grounded Bush from flying when he missed a medical exam and failed to meet performance standards. In one memo dated August 18, 1972, Killian wrote he was being pressured from higher-ups in the Guard to gloss over Bush's poor performance and to, quote, sugarcoat his evaluation. At the same time, a former Texas Speaker of the House, Ben Barnes, has come forward to say he abused his position of power by helping George Bush and others get a coveted slot in the National Guard in 1968. Last night, Ben Barnes was featured on 60 Minutes, while a number of CBS affiliates around the country did not play the piece. This is an excerpt, Dan Rather interviewing Ben Barnes on 60 Minutes.
A few months before George W. Bush would become eligible for the draft, Barnes says he had a meeting with the late oil man Sid Adger, a friend to both Barnes and then Congressman George Bush, father of George W.
Do you remember what he said?
Well, it's been a long time ago, but he said basically, would I help young George Bush get in the Air National Guard?
Barnes says he contacted his longtime friend, General James Rose, the head of Texas Air National Guard.
I was a young, ambitious politician doing what I thought that was acceptable, that was important to make friends, and I recommended a lot of people for the National Guard during the Vietnam era as Speaker of the House and as Lieutenant Governor.
And you recommended George W. Bush?
Yes, I did.
Now, you said you did this for others, what can only be called preferential treatment for President Bush. Would you describe it as that?
Oh, I would describe it as preferential treatment. There were hundreds of names on the list of people wanting to get in the Air National Guard or the Army National Guard. I think that would have been a preference to anybody that didn't want to go to Vietnam, that didn't want to leave. We had a lot of young men that left and went to Canada in the 60s and fled this country. But those that could get in the reserves or those that could get in the National Guard, chances are they would not have to go to Vietnam.
Former Texas Speaker of the House Ben Barnes, also former Lieutenant Governor, speaking with Dan Rather on 60 Minutes 2 last night. Barnes also said, quote, "I don't think I had any right to have the power I had to choose who was going to Vietnam and who was not going to Vietnam. I was maybe determining life or death." Yesterday, the Boston Globe reported a reexamination of President Bush's military records show the president fell well short of meeting his military obligations in the National Guard. According to the Globe, twice during his Guard service, Bush signed documents pledging to meet training commitments or face a punitive call-up to active duty. But records show he didn't meet the commitments or face the punishment. And a group called Texans for Truth recently announced an advertising campaign questioning whether George Bush ever trained with the Alabama Air National Guard. The ad quotes a retired lieutenant colonel in the Alabama unit who says he searched for Bush but never met him in 1972 or 1973.
I heard George Bush get up and say, "I served in the 187th Air National Guard in Montgomery, Alabama." Really? You know, that was my unit. And I don't remember seeing you there. So I called friends, you know, "Did you know that George served in our unit?" "No, I never saw him there." It would be impossible to be unseen in a unit of that size.
Texans for Truth is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
And that was the ad from a group called Texans for Truth, that ad released this week. We're joined in the studio by Ian Williams. He's UN correspondent for The Nation magazine, and he has just published a new book. It is called Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. Well, can you talk about the latest news from what the Boston Globe revealed to what Ben Barnes, the former Texas Lieutenant Governor and House Speaker, had to say?
Well, what he said has, we've known this for some time. He had to depose in a lawsuit a few years ago, and he said basically the same thing. And I presume he's being very careful this time because Karl Rove is not merciful and he will be done for perjury if he deviates from what he said in the lawsuit. And he's denying still, he's still not saying there was a direct connection, but it's quite clear that the Bush family used their influence consistently throughout this period. And what's, well, the documents don't really add that much new. In a, some sense, they sort of fill in the existing picture that George Bush got in on preferential treatment, and then he got away with a lot while he was in the National Guard because somebody up there was looking after him. But it's indisputable, as the Texans for Truth ad showed, nobody saw him in Alabama. There were pilots waiting to see him. They wanted to get, you know, hotshot political connections. They were eager to network with this guy. He never turned up. And his own memories of this period are always very sort of hazy. He develops convenient amnesia when you ask him, well, you know, you must remember, what did you see? But all of this is coming, I think the interesting bit is it's coming now, because a lot of this material has been around for a long time. It was around when I did the book. But the fact, this is blowback. This is because of the Swift Boat ads, I think, and the fact that Kerry has now made this an issue, it's sort of emboldened the mainstream media to come out and deal with this stuff, which before they were regarding as smear and slime tactics. But a lot of it's been out there in the local press down south for a long time. And I think the best interview was the one, I think it was the Houston Chronicle in 1994, where Bush, a more candid Bush, said, "I had a choice between going to Canada or letting off a shotgun next to my ear. And I wanted to learn to fly, so I joined the Texas Air National Guard." That's instead of going to Vietnam. And the ironic thing is that this unit was actually known locally as Air Canada because it got you all the benefits of a flight to Canada with none of the political disadvantages. And his failure to turn up for the medical, that was the same as letting off a shotgun next to his ear. And the documents from CBS last night from Killian, that's really good new stuff, because they testify that he was directly told to turn up for his flight medical. He grounded himself. He wasted hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' training money by refusing to turn up for his medical. And it'd be interesting to find out just who was pulling the interference to cover him while he was in Alabama doing it, and why he didn't want to turn up for his medical.
What do you mean?
Well, the year before, in 1971, the Pentagon had introduced mandatory drug testing, for example. And we can only speculate, but that could be one reason why you wouldn't want to turn up for a flight medical if it revealed that you were using drugs or abusing alcohol or whatever, because it would then put on your record why it was that you were regarded as unfit for flying. And that's why a lot of people want to see his disciplinary records and his medical records made public. But as we keep saying, the White House keeps saying they've released all documents, and then more documents keep turning up when people dig deeper. It's a continuous process of disclosure. Just how much will be disclosed between now and November the 2nd is going to be very interesting. And as we can see, there's a lot of people in the media, all those CBS affiliates, who don't want this stuff exposed.
It's interesting. The New York Times reporting that the White House recently called the president of NBC News to discourage the network from broadcasting interviews with the best-selling biographer Kitty Kelly. She has authored a new book on the Bush family and charges that President Bush was a cocaine user and that he once used cocaine at Camp David while his father was president.
That makes a direct liar of him, because his campaign said some time ago that he had not used drugs since 1974. They didn't say what he'd done before then, but if they said they said categorically not since 1974, well, his father was in Camp David well after 1974, so if he's using them then. And the issue here is not what a young and brash kid did. The fact that this is a persistent... this has been persistent about Bush's career from the beginning. He's been spoiled, he's broken the rules, he's been covered for it. And now he's president, he's spoiled, he breaks the rules, and people are still trying to cover for him, like at NBC.
What about going to Harvard Business School? What had to be done since he was in the National Guard?
Well, to the credit of Texas, the University of Texas had turned him down for law school because his qualifications weren't there. It took a Harvard affirmative action program for rich WASP kids to get him there. So, you know, well done, University of Texas. But for Harvard, he had to get his document signed saying that he'd fulfilled his full National Guard duty. And if you look at the pay records, what happened on his return from Alabama at the beginning of May, his commanding officer said, "We are not able to assess this officer's performance because he hasn't been seen for 12 months. And then you see a huge sort of concentration of duties marked up for whether he turned up for them in Texas in the first 30 days of first 30 or 40 days of that of May, June, July. And that cleared him to go to Harvard then. They gave him the transfer to go to the Massachusetts unit that he never turned up for. So basically he just sort of disappeared off the records.
We're talking to Ian Williams. His book is called Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. You talked about how Kerry has made this an issue, but it seems that it was clearly George Bush, Karl Rove, that has started making this an issue, sort of following on the Karl Rove path, attack from your weakness to the other guy's strength. Here you have Kerry, the decorated Vietnam veteran, and they're immediately attacking him, and they're attacking from Bush's weakness, which is his whole record. But they started it with their own ads.
Now, this is blowback, but they haven't been good at blowback. I mean, they bankrolled a bunch of Islamic jihadists in Afghanistan in the times past, and then wondered why it all happened to them, and they started the Swift boats this time, and they're suddenly surprised that the Democrats finally are coming back playing dirty.
But we can go way back to the campaign when Michael Moore talked about President AWOL, talked about Bush, and the fierce attack from the White House. How dare you say AWOL? Can you talk now about the records and whether they indicate AWOL?
Well, it was reinforced yesterday. His commander, Jerry Killian, ordered him to turn up for his flight medical. He refused to turn up. This is the same as Sergeant Carmen Mejia refusing to go to Iraq. He refused a direct order. And no one has explained. There's no documentation to say what happened. Was there a disciplinary inquiry? There should have been. He was grounded. There was no inquiry board. I mean, something. There are documents there, or there's been a really good cover-up that people are not confessing up to for obvious reasons. He did not, during wartime, he did not turn up for his duty.
And how do you...
How else are you going to define it? Apart from minimum AWOL, which I think is 30 days. But this was more than 30 days, so he really gets into desertion in wartime.
How do you respond to those who are saying, here is Kerry trying to fight a war again 35 years ago, while here is Bush looking at the war today in Iraq and looking ahead?
Well, as I said, there's a direct line here. Bush has continually evaded the truth. He's lied, dissimulated. He's still lying and dissimulating about this period. The real issue about Vietnam, of course, is that we don't seem to have learned any lessons. We're having an action replay of Vietnam in Iraq now. There are young people, economic conscripts, being sent off to die in a war that was lied about. I mean, the Vietnam War was in effect started by lies about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, a faked Vietnamese attack. This war was started by lies about about weapons and the United Nations that George W. Bush was repeating at the RNC last week. So this is this is all in a par on a direct line, and it really speaks to the issue that currently half of the garrison, the American garrison in Iraq, are National Guardsmen who didn't get the option to tick off a box saying no to overseas service like George W. Bush. And you find that he and McCain even try to conflate this and say, if you to attack my service in the National Guard is to attack the National Guardsmen now. And this is completely different. The National Guard in the Bush era was there to avoid going into war. The National Guard now are being sent to war, and they're being kept in the war when their time of service is finished with stop loss orders. So, I mean, this is not dwelling in the past. This is bringing the issue right to the present, to Bush's present behavior.
And what about this documentation? I mean, now the Bush White House attacking the Pentagon, saying they didn't release the documents, all of the documents. What does that mean? And what documents are there? Where do you look?
Well, the documents, I think, the AP is now suing under Freedom of Information for very specific documents. And the key ones, I think, are to do with the medical examination that he should have had in July, August of 1972 in Alabama that he didn't turn up for. He was grounded. I mean, this is very important for a pilot. You know, this is... If you can't fly, this is exactly the equivalent of letting off a shotgun next to your ear. You're making yourself unfit for duty. And he's never explained why. He has tried to explain. He said his plane was going to be phased out, so he didn't think it was worthwhile turning up. You know, can you imagine a junior lieutenant in Iraq saying, well, I think the war's almost over, I needn't turn up this time. I don't think the Pentagon would look kindly on this. In fact, the plane was actually in service for 2 years after he had after he'd left Texas, so it was still flying. He should have been flying it. It even got alerted for a major air defense operation while he was still in Alabama. The guy was shirking. He was away, and he's still not explained it.
Ian Williams, you're a correspondent for The Nation magazine at the UN. How is this playing internationally?
I think. Well, people are internationally are always bemused at the American obsession with Vietnam, and I think a lot of people are looking at John Kerry and saying, well, excuse me, was he for or against the war in Vietnam? And pretty much is he for or against the war in Iraq? So I think we're wondering why it is that the war is still an issue. I mean, 58,000 Americans died, 3 million Vietnamese died, 1.5 million Cambodians died, and everybody is making an issue about whether John Kerry got medals or not. And somebody somewhere should get up and say sorry to all those dead people. And it should be the people who supported that war, not the ones who opposed it.
Ian, finally, in the research for your book, Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past, what were you most surprised by finding?
I think that my biggest surprise was to discover the way that George W. Bush is still wrapping himself in the flag and the uniform. At the time when I wrote that, one third of his major policy statements had been on military bases, and he loves wearing uniform. You've seen the famous picture of him with his swelling codpiece on the USS Abraham Lincoln in the flight suit. He looks like a young kid with his first cowboy suit when he's in uniform. He loves it. There's obviously something deeply psychological, but it's making up for the fact he didn't do military service. He's wrapped himself in all of the glory of a veteran and military, and he is possibly the least qualified person, apart from Dick Cheney, who didn't turn up at all, to do this. But it's very dangerous, because he's playing to a streak in American life of the not so much the military, but the people who see the military as a repository of Republican values, of, you know, the one incorruptible part of American society. these people have very low regard for politicians, journalists, lawyers, but the military, they're the people who make sacrifices. And he's wrapped himself in that. And what he's saying now is, you cannot criticize my war in Iraq because you're criticizing our military serving abroad, and I represent our military. I was surprised by the number of times he refers to himself as commander-in-chief. The word is hardly ever off his lips. He's always calling himself the commander-in-chief. Well, a commander-in-chief who ignores the advice of his own military, leads us into a war that he declared was over 15 months ago when he landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln. It was to announce an end to significant hostilities. It was mission accomplished. He's a lousy commander-in-chief on his current record, and he's got no rights to his pretensions for the military on his past record.
Ian Williams, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The author of the book, Deserter, Bush's War on Military Families, Veterans, and His Past. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're joined by two whistleblowers, one from Britain and one from Denmark. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, the British newspaper The Observer exposed a highly secret and aggressive surveillance operation directed at United Nations Security Council members by the U.S. ahead of the vote on Iraq. The Observer obtained a top-secret NSA memorandum that outlined a surveillance operation involving intercepting home and office telephone calls and emails of UN Security Council members, focusing, quote, on the whole gamut of information that could give U.S. policymakers an edge in obtaining results favorable to U.S. goals or to head off surprises. The target of the surveillance were the so-called Middle Six delegations, including Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Mexico, Guinea, and Pakistan, who could swing a Security Council vote on Iraq. In a story that's received almost no media coverage in the United States, the former British intelligence employee who leaked the memo, Catherine Gunn, faced up to 2 years in prison for violating the Official Secrets Act before the charges were lifted. In her first appearance in the United States, Catherine Gunn joins us from Washington, D.C., where she's attending a gathering of whistleblowers organized by perhaps the country's best-known whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg. In 1971, Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and the Washington Post. The 7,000-page document exposed the true story behind the U.S. decision-making in Vietnam. He was charged with 12 felony counts, posing a possible sentence of 115 years. The charges were dismissed in 73 on grounds of governmental misconduct against him. Also attending the whistleblowers gathering is Major Frank Greville, a former military intelligence officer from Denmark, who was fired for leaking classified reports that showed no weapons of mass destruction would be found in Iraq. He currently faces charges for breaching the country's official information law. He also joins us from Washington, D.C. today. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Catherine Gunn. If you could briefly tell us, though we have covered the story, unlike most of the U.S. press, about what you did, about where you were working, how you got the information about what the U.S. and Britain were doing around spying on U.N. Security Council members.
Hi, Amy. Well, first, can I just say that I am still covered by the Official Secrets Act, and I will be until my deathbed. So I'm not about to jeopardize myself again. But I was working for Government Communication Headquarters in the UK, which is the equivalent to NSA here in the US. And I was a Chinese linguist at the time, and this email crossed my desk in my inbox in January of 2003. At that time, as we all know, it was a crucial time for the UN in its decision-making process as to whether or not a resolution was needed with regard to Iraq and its alleged weapons of mass destruction. So when I saw this email asking GCHQ's help to bug the six swing nations to get a vote for war with Iraq, I was very angry at first and very saddened that it had come to this, and that despite all the talk from both Tony Blair and George Bush about how important it was to get the UN on board and to legitimize any kind of aggression, that they were actually going around it in such low-handed manner. So I decided that the risk to my career was minute compared to the upcoming war in Iraq, and the best thing to do for me was to leak this information to the press so that everybody else could have the information, and hopefully it could avert this disastrous course of events that have occurred since.
And ultimately, you faced trial. What exactly was the sentence you faced, and what did you think before you did this about the penalty?
Well, the maximum sentence is 2 years. I don't think anybody's actually served more than 6 months for the Breach of Official Secrets Act. They didn't, in fact, charge me straight away. I was arrested on suspicion of breach of Official Secrets Act in March 2003, but they didn't charge me until November. Now, the in-betweening months, I was bailed and rebailed, and my life was on standstill. I was in limbo, and it was a very difficult time for me and my family because we just did not know what the future held for us. As it turned out, in November, they decided to charge me, and we were all pretty astounded by that decision because we knew that so many people supported my action. And the result of their charging me in November was that in February of this year, they were forced to drop it because my defense team requested the full legal advice from Britain's Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, and they refused to hand this over. So they either had something to hide or they felt that they were on a losing battle.
I want to turn now to Major Frank Greville, a Danish case, the Danish Prime Minister telling Parliament that government intelligence suggested Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and that this justified Danish involvement in the war. Then two Danish journalists ran a story in one of Denmark's largest newspapers that there had, in fact, been no credible evidence that Iraq had possessed such weapons. The journalist's source turned out to be a Danish military intelligence officer, Major Frank Greville, who said he'd written some of the intelligence assessments himself. He was fired for passing secret documents to the media, and the Prime Minister denied misleading the Parliament. Frank Greville now joins us as well in the Washington studio. Can you tell us your story, how you assessed that there were no WMDs, and why you decided to pass this information on?
Hi, Amy. Well, to make it short, it all started back in August of 2002 when we were prompted to provide reports, and we did so continuously afterwards, reports on Iraq. And at that time, we realized I mean, I was a member of a small group dealing with the WMD. We realized that we had virtually no sources of our own, so that we had to rely entirely on US and UK information, and that would be final reports, intelligence estimates issued and handed to us. So that what we did then was virtually a rip-off. It continued all the way until the Danish Parliament passed the law on the 19th of March 2003 to join the so-called Coalition of the Willing. The Parliament, in my opinion at that time, didn't receive the information it needed to make a sound decision. I waited to react until about 1 year later. That was in January, February of this year, when I saw that there was an ongoing debate in the Danish Parliament where the opposition was in vain trying all the time to get hold on at least some of the documents that the government had, but were not at that time presented to the Parliament. And I couldn't, as a democratic citizen, live with the fact that the government was holding crucial documents. So finally, I decided to and made contact to these journalists who wanted to see some hard facts, hard evidence, before they would run a story on it. So I only had a few days to decide whether I would hand out the documents or not, and finally, I did.
And Major Frank Revel, what do you face right now? You're going to trial.
Yes, my trial is scheduled to start next month. The verdict is expected on November 2nd, and I face up to 2 years imprisonment. I don't expect it to get such a harsh treatment. Actually, there's a loophole stating that if the information leaked is vital to should we say, the interest of the public, I could actually go scot-free. So I'm not quite certain what will happen. But the good thing is that this is only the first court hearing. I mean, that there is still the possibility of making an appeal to the next level court. And in my case, I will also see it as a possibility to go to the Supreme Court. So
you are now in Washington along with Catherine Gunn. Do you have a message for government employees, perhaps, for people in Washington around the issue of whistleblowing and the U.S. government?
Well, as a non-U.S. citizen, I cannot make an appeal directly to U.S. public employees to reveal whatever information that have. But I can only say that I'm going to do that at home, and I strongly support the U.S. movement, the U.S. Network of former whistleblowers or former employees in their efforts to convince present employees to give away whatever they have.
Catherine Gunn, we just have 15 seconds. I ask you the same question about a message you have to government employees, perhaps, or others in this country.
Yeah, well, like Frank, as a non-U.S. citizen, I can't advocate or pressure people to do anything. All I can say is that you have to live with your conscience at the end of your life. It's the only thing that you have that belongs to yourself and nobody else. So I would just say, always follow your conscience.
Catherine Gunn and Major Frank Revel, I want to thank you for being with us. And that does
thank
it for
you.
Today's program. Contacts at our website, democracynow.org. Our producers are Mike Berkshire, Hope Kadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Tonight I'll be with Arundhati Roy in Buffalo at the First Presbyterian Church at 8. Tomorrow in Chico, California, then at Golden Gate with on Saturday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.